I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better on this special Valentine's Day episode. In the red corner, it's A Bug's Life, as a scientist downs a bottle of champagne and decides to try out his teleportation device for the very first time. Turns out that wasn't the best idea, as Jeff Goldblum finds out. It's a case of Fly Me to the Gloom in 1986's The Fly.
There is a limit, even to the imagination, where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Those weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
While in the blue corner, they say beauty is only skin deep. Well, this movie puts that theory to the test with a villain who literally has no skin. But he doesn't let that knock his confidence with the ladies. It's Clive Barker's directorial debut from 1987, Hellraiser.
Beyond any terror you have imagined. A nightmare.
No.
Unlike anything you have witnessed. Is born.
So what connects these two movies and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Podders! Happy Valentine's Day week! I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
And as you just heard, in celebration of Valentine's Day, we are doing The Fly versus Hellraiser. Guys, lady and gentlemen, Happy Valentine's Day week. What is the connection?
I've got one.
Is it Valentine's Day that you keep saying?
Oh, no, I didn't even think of that. Right, you ready?
Mm.
It actually works on two levels. Ready? Mm-hmm. The course of true love never did run smooth. Yeah? Get it? Because of Jeff Goldblum's bumpy fly face and a pinhead.
Oh, and also because of the sort of the film of sort of fluid that is all over Frank's body throughout Hellraiser.
But then that would be very smooth. Like if you put a coin on his head.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It would just roll off.
It's the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
still opposite. Works. Yeah.
Is it? Don't look at me. Because I feel like they both say that or they both allude to that.
I don't think they say it like that. I think it's more like, don't look at me. I think they go, don't look at me. I'm a monster.
I guess Hellraiser is, don't look at me.
Yeah, he is.
The fly, how does he say it?
I don't think he does say it.
Okay.
I think it's more sort of, help me.
Yeah, it is help me.
Any other guesses?
No.
No.
Nope. Just one each this week. All right, cool. The actual connection is, if you are ready, so yeah, Lady Gaga provided the inspiration for this with her tuneful song, Bad Romance, because both of these movies do involve quite a bad romance.
Mm. Yeah, we got that.
Yep. You there?
20 minutes later.
All right, then. So tell me, before we progress, did you enjoy my choices this week?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this, actually. I like both of them very much.
First watch?
Not for The Fly, but I saw it when I was very, very young. And you know, there's always a film where you saw it when you were too young and it scared you to death. So I hadn't seen it. And it really frightened me because I think I only saw the vomit bits and things like that. And I was about six. I wasn't supposed to see it. So I've not watched it again until last night.
And Hellraiser?
So I'll tell you when we get to. I've got so much weird, I've got strange history with that film, but I'll save it.
All right, Chris, how about you? Both of them, I imagine you've seen.
Yeah, but I was too scared to watch horror films when I was a kid. So I saw them both when I was in my teens. Mm. But I feel like The Fly was, I mean, Hellraiser, I don't think we were that aware of it as kids in the 80s. But The Fly, you're looking like you're going to disagree with me, but The Fly was a big one, I think. It was the film like you were challenged to see, or people would talk about it. Have you seen there's a film where someone vomits on someone's arms and it melts? Like that was, I remember those conversations, and it was one of those things that you were like dared to watch almost.
Yeah. Well, I really remember Hellraiser from the 80s because of the poster. I remember seeing...
Do you remember the poster? Yeah.
I didn't see it until I was a little bit older, but I do remember that iconic poster of just Pinhead there.
Yeah.
Holding a box, wasn't it? It was him standing there holding the box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
And The Fly, I remember watching it, but I'm guessing I was of an age where it either didn't scare me because I was older, or it just didn't scare me. I just remember The Fly, and I was really not looking forward to watching The Fly again because I remember the ending. And it's a sad, 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 heartbreaking ending. And that's why I wasn't looking forward to it. The first half, I prefer. I enjoyed it more this time because I was prepared, but it's that bit at the end. We'll get to it. All right, then. So, Victoria, you had Hellraiser. Chris, you had The Fly. We do it chronologically, which means Christopher, you start us off.
Can I apologise for my introduction first? I had to write it a bit hungover on the tube during rush hour. I'm not sure how this is going to go.
All right, strap in.
I know a young scientist who became a fly. We all know why he became a fly. Perhaps he'll die. I know a young scientist who puked on an arm. It caused alarm when he puked on an arm because he caused harm. I know a young scientist who became a fly called Seth Brundle Fly, and then he died.
That was it. Chris, that was amazing.
Really?
Honestly. I was
super embarrassed about that.
Do not be embarrassed.
And I was really hoping no one was looking over my shoulder seeing what I was writing, because I would have looked insane.
Yeah, they would have moved.
Did you turn around and everyone on the carriage was crammed down one end? All I can say is drink more, Chris.
Yeah, honestly, best work.
Drink more. A great introduction.
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone. Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Tell us a little bit about what goes on in this, because I'd forgotten a lot of it, especially the start, the build-up.
Well, as a kid, I watched the Vincent Price one.
Right, I did too.
Which is where all this comes from. Have you seen the Vincent Price one?
No.
It's not good. It's a bad, it's a famous so-called classic. It's just a bad horror film.
Well, in its defense, it was made in 1958.
Yeah.
And while this one, The Fly, David Cronenberg's version, went on to win Best Oscar for makeup, that one didn't, because it's like a cartoon head on a fly and a fly's arm. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, it was based, we have Playboy to thank for this film, by the way.
Do we?
Because the original the original short story was in Playboy.
Do
the
we?
Fly.
Really?
Yeah.
Do we really, though, have to thank them?
I we mean, literally for, do. For they one, paid for the story.
For one short story, do we still have to thank them? Yeah.
But it ends up being a human with a fly head and hand. Mm.
Okay.
And then at the end, it's a fly with a human's head. A little fly. So yeah, it's...
The end is disturbing, though. Did you not find the end disturbing? In the 1958 original, it's like the tiny fly with the human's head, the scientist's head, is trapped in a spider's web, and there's this huge spider advancing on it.
Yep.
And it's screaming, this tiny fly voice, "Help me! Help me!" And the guy just gets a rock and kills it before the spider can kill it. It's pretty harrowing.
Yeah.
The rest of it's bollocks, but that bit's really good.
And the other person we have to thank for it is Mel Brooks.
Okay.
Because Mel Brooks produced this. A different producer wanted to pull the money together to make this. Didn't know. Fox said, we will distribute this, but we won't give you the money. And he went to Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks liked the script. He said the script was bad, but the idea was good.
Mm.
And it ended up with our old friend David Cronenberg.
Yeah, well, Mel Brooks apparently is the one who came up with one of the most iconic taglines, I think, in movie history. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Other taglines, which one of them is really good, which I like as well. Something went wrong in the lab today. Very wrong. That's good.
Kind of on a theme, isn't it?
less good is half man, half insect, total terror.
I like that.
Really?
I like the rule of three. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I just heard RoboCop in my head.
So they pitched it to Cronenberg, who was interested but couldn't actually direct it because he was making Total Recall.
Yeah.
And then that all fell apart because he had a big argument with Dino De Laurentiis, as most directors seem to do. And so he was able to come on board, rewrite the script. Although it feels like a David Cronenberg idea because of all the body horror, but he said he actually didn't bring any of that to the story. That was all already there.
Mm.
He just brought the love triangle element to it, which is really what makes the film work.
Yeah. It does, yeah, because Gina Davis is a journalist at the start and she meets Jeff Goldblum at some kind of scientist convention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that she says, when she's like, "I'm going to, nice chat, I'm going to move on because I've got other stories."
Yeah, she's very clear.
She does make out at the start, "I am a journalist covering this conference."
Yeah.
And then when they get back to his, and she goes, "Wow, you've got a teleportation device that actually works in your lab / warehouse flat, very trendy. You've got this that works. I'm probably going to write it up." And he goes, "You're a journalist?"
Yeah. He acts like he's shocked.
Yeah.
Does he also say, when he meets her at the convention, he's like, "Come back to mine, I'll make you a coffee." Does he say, because I hate this if it's true, does he say, "I've got an espresso machine"? Because I heard it and I was like, I should rewind it, but I really can't be bothered. And I hate it when people say espresso.
How do you feel about cappuccino?
It's disgusting.
But as you say, it starts at that party and literally the first line of the film is, "What am I working on? Something that will change the world and human life as we know it."
Correct.
That is going in hard, isn't it,
with your opening. Yeah, I love that. Like, just get to it.
And he's literally, the next line is espresso / "Do you want to come back and see my telepod?" Which is a hell of a chat up line. And so begins this love triangle. So as you said, we've got Jeff Goldblum plays a scientist called Seth Brundle.
Mm.
She is a journalist called Veronica Quaife.
Just very quickly, you know, we talk about how IMDb trivia is sometimes just people have gone, "This sounds funny, I'll put it in as a trivia." Someone wrote, "Seth Brundle, David Cronenberg named him after the Formula One driver, Martin Brundle."
What a load of bollocks. And then you've got her ex-boyfriend / boss, who's called Stathis Boran.
Yeah.
Mm.
They weren't messing about when they came with the names for this film.
No.
In this film. What I did notice this time for the first time, though, is that journey from the party to the flat. He's feeling sick and she says, "Have you drunk too much?" And he says, "No, I get motion sickness."
Yeah.
That's what the film's about. He's doing this experiment because he gets motion sickness and he wants to travel places without having to be in a car or a plane.
Why do you look so surprised?
Yeah. I've never noticed that before.
That's the worst thing about it.
Oh, do you think so?
Yeah, I really
I think that's
that.
Really clever.
I like
it's
it.
Not clever at all. Like, you don't need to give the character, like, if you are a scientist and you think you might be able to create a teleportation device, you don't need a backstory where you've
you
got
do.
A bit
you,
of,
who's going to bother otherwise?
No, I do love it. I do love it if he sort of came up with the plans and went, I could actually build a teleportation device. You know what? I love air travel, though, so I probably won't bother. Just put that to one side, make an espresso machine. Yeah. A sentient espresso machine.
So he's invented teleportation, and he says to Gina Davis, I will show you how it's done. I need an object from you. Yeah. Now, if someone said that to you, what would you give them?
Well, she goes to take her shoe off, so give him the fucking shoe.
But then she doesn't, like, does she, Vicky? What does she do?
She takes off a silk stocking.
Which takes ages because her legs are so long.
Of course. But he handles that quite well. I mean, it's a weird moment because it's like, is this gonna happen or not happen? It's like, you have just taken your tights off. Yeah. I don't know.
But she does find the time to go, I mean, I'm doing this because I never wear jewellery.
Yeah.
Because he asked for some jewellery, like something important, something unique to her. But the whole point of that, I thought, was the fact that, so it's obviously not a trick. It has to be something that I can't have just put in there. It can't be a magic trick, something common.
Yeah.
It's like, well, there's only one pair of silk stockings in the world and you have them.
It could still be a magic trick.
I like the fact that they don't mess about with like stuff that you'd sort of think they'd sort of dwell on. Like, she'd go, what? When he goes, I call them telepods.
Yes.
And she just goes, okay. There's no sort of like, let me explain what telepods are. And then he goes, they're controlled by this Commodore 64.
But well, she's a science major.
You're judging it with modern eyes.
I am.
That was futuristic in 1986. But the issue with the teleportation is it can only work on inanimate objects. So that's the that's the issue in the movie. He is experimenting on animals.
Yeah. Did you not think it would have been funny if I was really distracted? But when he blows up a monkey, and that's obviously very sad.
He turns a baboon inside out.
As a turn of phrase, blows up a monkey, I'd rather.
But then he tries it again, and obviously it's like, oh, tension, and there's all this smoke coming out of the telepod. And I thought, just for a minute, I was convinced that the monkey steps out like Clever Gremlin with a monocle and was like, da-da, it worked. And I was like, oh, it hasn't. Oh, well, never mind.
And it could have done, because the guy that did the visual effects on this is the guy that did the visual effects on Gremlins.
I must Chris have Wallace, known that.
Who was going to do Gremlins 2, but decided to do this instead of Gremlins 2. So, okay. And then won the Oscar for this, which was a wise decision. Because as much as I love Gremlins 2, I don't think it would have won the Oscar for it. But yeah, Chris Wallace won the Oscar for this and turned down Gremlins 2 to do it. Hey, the baboon thing, that is kind of like, it's a great moment, and I actually leaned in when you see the bloody sort of paw hit the glass. You're like, what on earth has happened? And I leaned into my video screen on my Commodore 64. I leaned in to watch it pop. And then he goes, well, that didn't go well, so I'll probably try it again with a steak. My feeling is probably do the steak first and then the baboon. Because if I was that baboon, I'd be pulling my hair out if I hadn't been turned inside out and didn't have any hair anymore.
Well, I think there is a deleted scene where he puts a cat and a monkey in there.
Yeah.
And it comes out a deformed cat monkey. And David Cronenberg said they had to cut it because audiences felt like it deranged the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And that you completely lose sympathy for our so-called hero.
Okay.
Yeah, the producer, Stuart Kornfeld, because it was after a Toronto screening where they kept that scene in with the mutant cat monkey, cat baboon. Stuart Kornfeld said, which is agreeing with what David Cronenberg said, if you beat an animal to death, even a monkey cat, your audience is not going to be interested in your problems anymore.
I shouldn't find that funny. It's horrendous.
So, having done the baboon and the steak, he gets drunk and experiments on himself.
He has two glasses of fizz, and he's like, fuck it, let me try. Like, two glasses.
We all know someone like that.
But it's true. Because I know it's, but it's very clever because it sets up at the party at the start. She goes, you don't really drink very much.
True,
do you?
Yeah, that's true.
But I'm still like, I mean, dude, it's like, it's because she's had a glass. I counted, I worked it out.
Yeah.
She's had a glass. He's had a glass. There's still about a third left. So he's had in the region of a third of a bottle of fizz.
Yep.
And he's like, I'm going to fucking get my teleporter.
Bearing in mind that he's hungry because she's walked out on their Chinese meal. The first thing he does is like, I'm just going to get a takeaway for me because I'm pissed. Mm. I'm not going to teleport myself.
He's also really tall and he's clearly been working out for this movie.
Yeah.
I think it would take quite a lot to get Jeff Goldblum drunk. Mm.
They say that his height and his stature really helped with the baboon. Just so you know, the baboon is called Typhoon.
Are you lying?
No, this is genuine. Typhoon the baboon. And David Cronenberg said, there's no such thing as a tame baboon. They're very volatile and it was quite scary.
I bet it was.
And the trainer said that it was because the Jeff Goldblum was so big and strong that he formed this bond with the baboon. And that's when it runs out and hugs him and he could dominate it. And he said otherwise, there could have been big trouble on the set with some of the female members of the crew. Which is a weird thing to say.
What?
Yeah.
I'm calling bollocks on all of that.
Really?
Yes. So a fly teleports with him.
But it's in quotation marks about what David Cronenberg said. I treat that as fact. If there's quotation marks, because otherwise you're in a whole world of shit.
I think if you've been to the gym, it's not going to make a baboon respect you. I'm just
And this
saying.
Is from a man who works out 3 hours a day.
You'll find out.
3 hours, not 3 hours. So, yeah, a fly gets into the teleportation device. And so he fuses with Fly and his transformation begins. What was your favourite aspect of Seth Brundle's transformation? Because it goes through a variety of stages.
Climbing on the ceiling.
Climbing on the ceiling.
Yeah.
Alex, have any of you experienced any of these things that he goes through? Because
yes.
I've grown up.
Me too. I had a hairy back for a while.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
How coarse was it?
Not that coarse. I mean, you didn't need scissors to get through it. I mean, you could just like,
You're lucky then.
Wow. But you are an incredibly hairy man.
I am, yes. I'm more ape than human.
Yeah, like a massive hairy baby.
I would definitely respect muscly Jeff Goldblum.
There are four scenes I remember in this movie, like before I started watching it again, that had stuck in my mind. One is the hair sticking out of his scratch, which I found pretty gross. Mm. The other is the arm breaking during the wrestling thing where the bone sticks out. That imprinted on my mind. And the other two are to do with his transformation. Mm. One is what you mentioned earlier, dissolving a hand with vomit. Mm. But the one that sticks in my mind the most is his penis in the bathroom cabinet.
What?
I did wonder what it was.
Yeah. Did you know? No, remember? Yeah, I remember
watching
it.
It's very
the first
small
time.
Because it's all sort of curled up. Mm. And my
what
I know exactly what you're
talking
about.
You see his Goldblum?
Yeah, when all the bits have dropped off him and he opens the bathroom, the Museum of Brundlefly, whatever he calls it, and there's bits of him in there.
And he's got his ear in a jar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there was just this little slug.
Yeah.
And then my brain saw it and just thought, no.
So it's not on his body anymore?
No,
he's put it in the bathroom cabinet.
Really? Yeah. It's a dick in a box.
What about when and I couldn't watch it, and I think this might have been one of the things that scared me when I was little, but when he's, when he's peeling his nails off, like I can't deal with, like, obviously because it's a pressure point and it's a point of vulnerability. So teeth, eyes, nails, it's very common to feel so disgusted.
Have you not had to pull a nail off?
Oh.
I used to have to do it a lot.
Why?
Because I played...
Were you in the Spanish Inquisition?
No, I played hockey and you'd often get hit on the foot with a stick or a ball.
Oh, it was on your foot as well?
Yeah. Or it would happen on your finger and it would go black and the best thing to do was get it pull it off as soon as you could so it can grow... A new one can grow back.
I had a friend who got ingrowing toenails, like religiously, as a child.
It was a religious thing.
Like worship them.
Like, no, it was like stigmata.
It happened every Sunday. Yeah.
It's my religious ingrowing toenail.
And also, I should say, I've already copyrighted that as a pitch for a movie. It's like the Patricia Arquette movie, Stigmata, but with toenails coming off.
It did hurt, I believe.
But he had his toenails, his big toenails, chemically removed. So now he has no big toenails. Like it's just a sort of smooth area of scar tissue where they once were. I didn't mind it, but it was kind of disconcerting when you first see it. It's like, give me a warning. It's like when it's like when Brundlefly vomits over the donut in this and he just goes, and she goes, what the fuck? And he's like, right. Sorry, that's disgusting. Yeah. I've been doing it so often, I'd forgotten.
I love that that is so graphic or such a disgusting concept that not even David Cronenberg will properly show it. So there's a scene, clearly Gina Davis has filmed him regurgitating food and then eating it again. We don't get to see it. Stathis Boran sees it on a video and we just see his expression while he's watching it. Yeah. Even Cronenberg was like, nope.
Yeah. Well, there was a deleted scene where after he dissolves Stathis's foot, there was a long sequence where his proboscis comes out of his mouth and he starts drinking the fluid out of the stump.
Bloody hell. I'm very sorry if anyone's listening to this over breakfast.
And not everyone's hungover.
Can we talk about sex?
Sure.
So have you ever said to a sexual partner or have them say to you, how can you keep going? You can't have any fluid left in your body.
Yeah, it's a
what a messed up line.
It's really bad. It's a bit of a mood killer. How can you keep going? I need a drink of water. That would be fine.
Maybe it was because there was an over-familiarity between the two of them because Gina Davis was Jeff Goldblum's girlfriend at the time of this film. And it was...
What film did they meet on?
Earth Girls Are Easy.
Earth Girls Are Easy. Potential future Clash Pod title.
Fine.
But yeah, I wonder whether she was just like, I remember that joke we did the other night. Let's put it in the script. It sounds like it's. I mean, I'd be comfortable with it if you'd been with someone for a while.
Yes,
it's kind of funny.
So he starts becoming Brundlefly, which I never really liked that term.
No, I
feel like that's a bit clumsy calling him Brundlefly.
I don't mind it.
And so this is when it all starts. It's kind of fun,
yeah,
and exciting and horrific, but then it starts turning tragic as his humanity drains away. And that's when this sort of romantic comedy horror turns into something of a tragic drama.
Yeah, he seems very, very into sex once he becomes part fly.
Is that a fly thing, though?
Well, this is... Thank you for asking, Victoria. I did look this up. I was like, are flies
horny,
horny little shits? Are they always after a little bit
They're always on.
So I typed in fly mating, and this is a bit of an eye-opener. I didn't know how flies mated. They do have sexual intercourse as such. I'll explain. If a female fly wants to mate, she puts her ovipositor inside the male fly's genital opening.
You go, girl.
Yeah. It's located at the bottom of his abdomen. The ovipositor is a long, thin tube that extends from the end of the female's abdomen. When she isn't mating or laying eggs, it stays hidden. Once it's in place, the male releases sperm, which travel up through the female's reproductive tract to fertilize her eggs. The entire mating process, and this is where I felt emasculated by a housefly, lasts from 30 minutes to 2 hours. I was like, flies are having sex longer than me. You don't think that when you see a fly. You think it's in an in-and-out job.
Because everything about them is so quick.
Right. They don't even live that. I mean, so much of their life is spent having sex because they're only alive for like 15 days.
Happy days.
So their life is having sex and hanging out on shit.
Yeah, I'm pissing off
they
me.
They love shit, don't they? They love shagging and shit.
Sounds like a Berlin fetish club. yeah, but do you not find that? I've sort of, in a weird way, all the flies I've killed in my life with magazines, I suddenly felt a real guilt. I'm like, I sort of thought you were just like, it was quite a tragic existence smashing against this window, but...
I would like to pick you up on that. No one's ever actually killed a fly with a rolled up magazine because you always miss because they're quick.
Yeah, I was, in fairness, on a lot of steroids at the time, so I was very quick, but very angry.
I smashed the window through.
Speaking of sex, though, our friend Veronica does get preggers.
She does.
That's a sort of twist.
Yeah.
Two thirds of the way into the film, we get the dream sequence where she gives birth to
a maggot,
which I can remember that being one of the most shocking scenes. The first time you see it, you do not know that is a dream.
It's messed up.
Yeah.
It's really messed up.
It's horrible. It's horrible. Yeah. And that's David Cronenberg between her legs as well. I was like...
There's something wrong with that man.
He means like, probably going to cameo for the first time in one of my movies. Cool, cool, cool. What bit? Where the maggot comes out of her.
Yeah, gynecologist one.
David, you're drooling. I'm fine. So apparently, and this I call bullshit on this, but I'm still going to say it because I quite like it. It was Martin Scorsese asked to meet David Cronenberg, and after meeting him, said he looked like a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon, which inspired David Cronenberg to cast himself as a doctor.
Dead Ringers, maybe.
Maybe. Other sources say it was Gina Davis's idea because, you know, she likes it.
Cool.
So Brundlefly comes up with a plan, and that is to create the ultimate family by merging himself with his girlfriend and unborn child before he turns into full fly. Well, I think he decides that he wants to return to being a human, but he can't literally get rid of the fly in him. So he just feels like merging with more and more humans will bring back more humanity
to
him.
He needs to dilute.
I mean, he's gone mad. He's a mad scientist at this point, isn't he?
I mean, I thought it was, I don't even know if I should say this. I thought it was going to take a very dark turn, that she was going to like give him the fetus and then he would like merge with that because that would be enough human matter to put him back to normal. And I was really relieved when he was like, no, cause we'll just blend all together. Like, I was like, thank God for that, because that's a scene I don't want to see.
No. Yeah. And our old friend, Stathis Boran. Sorry, I just like saying it.
I couldn't get Stannis Baratheon out of my head. The whole thing, I was like, Stannis Baratheon? No, Stathis Boran.
But he comes back to save the day, essentially. What were your feelings about Stathis Borans?
I mean, I don't think that the editor of a respected science journal has a huge shotgun at his disposal.
I also don't.
It is America.
I don't think the editor of Particles magazine in this day and age would have an office like that, because it's like, this really harks back to when the print media mattered. You're like you would be in a cubbyhole, and like
you'd be working from home,
right?
But he's a full-on 80s douche for most of the movie. He really reminded me of Lewis from Die Hard.
Oh yeah,
to the point that I felt like he could be his cousin, just the way he looks and the way he talks.
Yeah, he really loses his shit in a shop as well when he finds out they're boinking, and he goes full weirdy beardy on.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, well, he's they've broken up, but he's still in her flat showering. He refuses to give his key back. He stalks her. He essentially attacks her in a shop.
Yeah. Well, he throws a leather jacket that she's holding across the shop floor, which I think is quite a statement. She's like, is this for him? It's over there now.
can't have it now.
But does Stathis redeem himself by the end of the film? I think he does, doesn't he? Yes. He agrees to take... He could walk well away from this.
He bloody should redeem himself as well. He is the cause of the whole film, because he sends that magazine to the flat.
Yeah.
And she goes, I'm going to go deal with this now. Leaving Jeff Goldblum on his own with his massive half bottle of champagne that puts him in the teleporter. Telepod. It's got a name. Yeah, I like Stathis, and I did think he got his comeuppance enough. I'm glad he didn't die, because I think that would have been too much. But I was grinning when he got his appendages melted off. I was like, that's good. You need to pay some debt. There needs to be your pound of flesh for what you've done here. And it's literally a pound of flesh.
And so the film ends with our star-crossed lovers parting ways as Seth begs Veronica to kill him.
It's so sad. She
blows it to fuck while crying.
But she sort of hesitates. It's like, what are you doing? Like,
loves him.
Yeah, I know, but you really want this abortion, and I think you should just, like, priorities, blow his head off, get your abortion, get your life back to normal.
I quite like the fact they don't overplay that I can't scene where she's like, she does it once. He points the gun at her, at his own head, and she goes, I can't. And like, you're like, oh, is this going to be for fucking ages? This is like Brad Pitt in Seven. What's in the box? But she goes, I can't. It's like there's a heartbeat before she actually does it.
And then that's it. It literally cuts to black.
Yeah.
It's I like the brutality with in which the film begins and ends. Like, there's no messing around. It's a tight 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And bang, we're out of here.
Yeah. I think the transformation of Jeff Goldblum, it is good. Not just like physically. I mean, although I think the makeup is incredible. I think just the way he becomes a proper dick.
Yeah.
Like, apparently flies are dicks as well. I didn't know that. Well, exactly.
Yeah, well, they're horrible in restaurants.
That's true.
They don't pay the bill properly.
They're very loud at the table.
That's why I hate fly tipping.
Oh, man.
didn't really work, but...
Did you write that on the tube
please.
As well?
Is that written down?
No.
Okay. You just came up with that. Okay.
He looks so pleased with you.
It was a bit of tension there. But the bit where he like when he's in the arm wrestling competition, he goes, if I beat you, the lady comes home with me.
And she's like, who says? And then she's like, okay, cool.
I like Tonya when she turns up, though, because like, he literally walks out the door with her after, and he's like, yeah, so I just ripped your boyfriend's bone out of his arm. Should we go back to mine? She's like, let's hit a few bars first. Like, priorities.
Yeah. Have you ever walked into a bar, though, where two men are arm wrestling?
No, yeah. I have not.
No.
I mean, nope.
If I did, I would leave.
Did you like the fact that Seth Brundle takes the same approach to dressing as you do and Albert Einstein does?
Yes.
I know. I saw the quote and I was like, I meant to pick you up on it at the time whenever you said it a few weeks
Is that
ago.
Where you got it from?
Of course
do you
it
think?
Is.
The fly rather than not being a scholar of Albert Einstein.
I got it from Albert Einstein.
No, he didn't. He got it from the fly.
He did,
and also
he?
At the time I was like, how dare you equate yourself with Albert Einstein because
so
you were...
Who? Him or me?
So in case people didn't listen to that episode or haven't seen the film, what is the principle there, Alex?
I wear the same jeans, boots and a variety of black t-shirts on a daily basis because... Like Albert Einstein. I don't want to have to waste mental energy on deciding what to wear each day, so I can commit that energy
to making the world
to the podcast,
to doing something great. So in many ways, like Brundle creates his telepods. Uh-huh. I have created this telepodcast.
Shut up.
So it's not because...
Fly tipping, everyone.
That's fair.
So it's not because you want to look like you're a member of the Strokes.
You are obsessed with me being in the Strokes. That is like the sixth time this week you've gone, in the Strokes though, eh?
You wish.
I don't. You wish. You clearly wish.
But, it, I mean, it does work narratively in the film because they make a big deal of him wearing the same clothes every day. And then as he's starting to transform into the Fly, he changes his clothes for the first time.
He puts on a check shirt and he looks better for it.
Well, no, doesn't he wear a leather jacket without a shirt underneath?
Without a shirt, yeah. He goes to that bar and he's like, hey, everyone. It's like, oh, you've got no top on.
And nice, you know that's how Goldblum dresses in real life.
He's like, this is how I always
have you ever
have
you ever met Goldblum?
Do you know what? I actually, no, I don't think I have.
I've written a script for him.
Did he ask you to?
It was part of the promotion of Independence Day 2. We filmed a fake advert with him, which I wrote the script for, which is super nice. Exciting hearing and watch. I went to meet with him I watched him record our ad.
That's cool.
Yeah. And he was brilliant. He was good. He improvised lines off the top of it, which were better than anything I wrote.
Oh, no.
Which he's done in this film as well.
I bet he has.
The scene where he's pouring the sugar in the cafe, which is quite a long speech of his. The first half was Cronenberg. The second half, he wrote the night before in the hotel room. And on the DVD, they show you what was written for him and then what he came up with. And it is effortless. And what he wrote was better than what Cronenberg came up with.
I think he's a very clever man.
He's a smart guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Hey, shall we do the bits?
Yes, let's do the bits.
Okay, let's do the bits. So let's start with MVW, your most valuable whatever. What could it be in this movie, Chris?
Jeff Goldblum as Seth Brundle. Obvious, but the production wanted him, Cronenberg wanted him, and the studio didn't. But I don't think this would happen now, but the head of the studio literally said to Cronenberg, this is a mistake. We don't think you should cast Jeff Goldblum in this role, but it's your mistake to make. Go and do it.
Wow.
Which is remarkable. And you can't imagine anyone else in that role now.
So basically what the studio head was doing was going, we didn't need to have this meeting because I'm going to let you do what you want to do anyway, but I'm going
to
go on record.
Yeah, so I don't get fired.
So I can say I told you so as well. I believe Michael Keaton was in the running, which would have been an interesting choice.
Mel Gibson. Apparently Mel Gibson turned this down to do Lethal Weapon.
But you can believe that Jeff Goldblum is the cleverest man in the world, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I just think he brings intense intelligence, but also an insecurity, and you buy into the jealousy that causes all this trouble, and he's quite vulnerable. It's inspired casting, and I think it really makes the film work.
It works because you feel sorry for him at the end. Even though he's like dissolving like Stathis's like bits, you're still like, there's that bit. I don't remember him being this sort of Quasimodo Phantom of the Opera figure, like where he's looking down on them from the ramparts of his castle. Like you're like, oh, this. I don't remember the bit where he smashes through the window
Neither
in the hospital.
Did I. That's insane. Insane. Like, why is the wall of a hospital made of glass for a start?
That's the only time when I was like, this is a bit.
And he like sort of hops away like a big frog.
but that is like your Hunchback or.
Yeah.
Or Phantom moment, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. What's yours, Chris?
I just did mine, Vicky.
That's what I meant, Vicky.
She's the other one.
Thanks.
She's the other one. I like Stathis. I thought because of the lines you get, like the total commitment to like being a dickhead. So when he says to her, like, you know, obviously you're breaking up with me, but can we still have sex? And she's like, shut up. He's like, fair enough. You know, don't ask, don't get, whatever.
Does anyone know what the actor's called?
Yeah. John Getz, is it?
What happened to him?
He was the editor of the Chronicle in Zodiac, is his sort of biggest other role. And he's done a lot of TV stuff.
And I like the other line when she's sort of confided in him that Seth has turned into a fly. And he's like, oh, that sounds really dreadful. He doesn't say that. It's not a quote. And then he's like, can I reclaim your body after this is over? It's like, take a fucking day off, man. But whatever. And also, it's the 80s. You know, you need a man for certain things. You should throw your lot in with the only man in America who can procure an abortion because you might need that one
in the middle of the night.
She's like, I need an abortion. He's like, I can't do this right now. It's like, can you not? I don't understand why you're not allowed to, but whatever. Different times.
Yeah, I was going to go with Stathis, but I have a problem because when he makes a joke, and she calls him, she goes, you're a petty schmuck. Mm. And then he laughs and he goes, ha ha ha. He snort laughs.
I've we all do that.
I don't do that. And if you do it, can you? You should. I don't think it's a character trait. I think as an actor, he probably snort laughs.
Yeah.
And I'd have gone, sorry, can I do that again? Because I snorted. But he does. He goes. Like a laughing pig.
Now, see, now you're making me feel awkward because I do that.
I don't feel awkward.
I think we all do it sometimes. Even if Alex claims he's never done it,
he has.
I sort of whistle after. I go. That's my curse. I'm going with. I love the fact that Gina Davis's character does something I can't do, which is smoke fucking Marlboro Reds.
Oh, God.
That was a strong cigarette.
I used to poke a hole in them because sometimes you couldn't get, like, back in the day, Marlboro Lights. Mm. And so you could take the back of your earring, if you really had to, and prod a hole in the filter just so you didn't. And bear in mind, you were like 16. You can handle a lot of smoke when you're 16. But everyone just like, so,
fresh lungs.
Yeah. That is disgusting, obviously.
Yeah, so my most valuable whatever is going to be the ashtray in her flat.
It's full.
It's the biggest ashtray in the world. It's a giant metal palm frond that is the length of her coffee table. And I was like, I got to get me one of those.
Yeah, but she doesn't empty it because people just didn't care. Like, her whole house must stink.
Yeah.
She smokes a lot. But then she's not like, I'll just tip those in the bin every day. Like, I'm just going to collect them.
It's when she comes back and she finds Stathis in her shower. And she's like, what the fuck are you doing here? It's like, I actually just came around for 30 seconds and now I stink of smoke, so I'm having a shower. Yeah. All right, then. Best scene.
It's not one scene. Well, it's kind of one scene, but basically the sort of first, the opening section. So within 2 minutes at this science expo thing, you get that there's going to be something between them and you want to spend more time with them. And that's really important because obviously the story is framed within a love story. So if you didn't want to spend more time with them and you didn't believe for a second that they would go back with each other, it's done. It's all over. You don't give a shit. So I think it's very economical and it's impressive the way that, obviously they've got a lot of chemistry, obviously. Mm. But yeah, I just think that's really impressive just to get on with it.
Chris,
would you have gone home with him?
Mm. Yeah.
Would you?
Well, because I love coffee. So yeah.
Espresso?
I love espressos.
And if you were that girl on the bar later in the movie, would you have gone home with him?
No. Because his face is not in a good place. He's got no t-shirt on and he's tried to buy me. And those are things I don't like.
$100 in an arm wrestle. I'm yours.
That's what I mean.
I mean, I'll go with that scene because that was the talk of the playground.
Really?
I can literally remember people, like older friends, older brothers saying, oh, have you seen The Fly? It's the film where he goes to a bar and he arm. I'd heard so much about that scene for about 10 years before I saw it. And it actually lived up to what people had said in terms of him, you know, snapping a guy's arm off.
That's it. 100%. It's that scene for me as well. Just
because it delivers.
It's like in a movie that is full of body horror. I don't remember him walking backwards, dragging her to the teleporter as his skin falls off and the fly head emerges from his skull. Yeah. And you'd think that would be the thing that you go, there's that scene in it. It's the arm wrestling scene where the bone comes out.
Because that's the thing, because it's stuff that could happen.
Mm.
The minute, like nails peeling off, stuff like that. And you're the same with teeth. Like, those are things that could happen to you. So you have that revulsion.
I saw it happen once on the telly in
The Fly.
The World's Strongest Man. They have an arm wrest section and a guy, literally his bone snapped out.
Shut up.
Yeah. It was horrendous. Man. And about 10 years ago, I'd say.
That's why I don't arm wrestle. That is why.
One of many reasons.
I thought that was going to be today's quiz, me and you arm wrestling.
I had £100 on it. So.
And I'd go home with you.
Good day all round.
All right. Mine's the arm wrestling scene too. Finally, what would you change?
I would change. I know it's controversial, and it might be a modern thing to say, but when he gets into the telepod, he sees the fly and he goes, like 5, 4, 3, 2.
Yes!
Goes, no!
Yeah.
That's what I would
change. I'm like, it's not the biggest telepod. That thing is flying around at that point. Yeah. When they do the digital recreation, it's like, it's right next to his bloody head.
Yeah.
He'd be like, fuck!
Yeah, and you can't stop it. Perfect.
That would be great. If it paused, like if he teleported halfway through, fuck, he'd be like, fuck!
And then come out,
fuck!
That's a great idea.
You're welcome, David Cronenberg. go on, Chris, what's yours?
I mean, I actually wouldn't want to see this, but it would be fun to see the fly. I would like him to have maybe sprouted wings and flown off.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been fun, but yeah, it would have ruined the film.
I mean, as much as I think it was the right thing to take it out. There's no part of me that doesn't want to see a mutant cat baboon, a cat monkey walking around. But actually, it's a bit of research I did because I love the vomiting on Stathis scenes. And then I found out what the fly vomit was actually made of. and it doesn't sound that bad. It was made of honey, milk, and eggs. And you're like, oh.
Like a sort of hair mask, right. Almost. Yeah. Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, be hungry.
Unless you're a vegan, that's not a nightmare. So, yeah, I wish I didn't know that because it makes it less grotesque. That is The Fly. Any more for any more?
No.
Great stuff.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Over to you, Victoria, for Hellraiser.
I watched Hellraiser, where a man, in seeking to sate his boundless sexual desires, ends up nailed to a slimy torture column with his face torn off, then enlists his ex-lover in a murder spree to put flesh back on his wet bones. So beware puzzle boxes. Harmless mind games for the inquisitive or enchanted portals for sadomasochistic interdimensional demons. Put it this way, if Chris asks you to play Jenga at his house, say no.
God, that's a lot. I've got to think. Can you say it all again?
I'm sorry. I've been pissing myself laughing for 12 hours. I'm really sorry. It doesn't even make any sense. Put it this. Jenga's not a puzzle box. It doesn't matter. Put it this way. If Chris asks you to play Jenga, say no.
At his house, specifically. If Chris asks you to play Jenga at his house, just say no.
Yeah, it is dilapidated house.
I do have Jenga at home.
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not doing it again.
Georgina's really good at it.
Is she now?
She's one of the ones who hasn't gone missing.
I have seen the future of horror. His name is Clive Barker. Within these walls, the unholy is unleashed. Hellraiser, a film by Clive Barker.
We'll tear your soul apart.
Oh, So I was very, really excited to talk about this film. I'm going to get this story out of the way because it's really embarrassing and it makes it clear what a twat I am.
Is this what you couldn't say or weren't going to say at the start?
So when you and you were like, oh, we're going to do Hellraiser, I was like, oh, and then this all came flooding back. I thought I'd seen Hellraiser because the poster is so familiar. It's basically everyone of our, I feel like everyone of our age, like, you know that poster so, so well. I thought I'd seen it when I was younger so much that I went to a Q&A with Doug Bradley when I was at college because I was like, I've seen that. That would be interesting. Then when I was in the audience, I was like, I haven't seen this.
So what had you seen?
I don't know.
Did you put your hand up and go, sorry, Doug, are you going to talk about Hellraiser at any point? He's like,
this is the
what?
Worst bit. The worst bit of the story was that I was sat with my friend and the questions, because obviously, and I can't bear not being the centre of attention for 5 minutes. And I was like, God, I'm so bored because I haven't got a fucking clue what anyone's talking about. And the questions are really boring. And my friend was like, ask a stupid question, because we're bearing on, we're like 16, we're idiots. Ask a stupid question. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Oh, we love those people at Q&As, don't we? Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Then,
oh, we do. Go on, V.
I'm mortified with this. I don't think this is funny. Oh, but finally, everyone's like, oh, so talk me through the anatomy of the scene or whatever. And I was like, Doug. And he was like, yeah. And then I was like, what would you say your favourite soup is? And obviously, it just went silent. Me and my friend are like, oh, where's the fucking funny? And he's like, don't be a dick, but didn't say that. And he very graciously answered the question. I thought that was the funniest thing that I'd ever done in my life. And then Hellraiser then brings all these emotions back for me of like, I thought I was funny, and then shame and confusion. And I hadn't seen this film, very much not.
So just for the record, what is Pinhead actor Bradley's favourite soup? Do you remember?
He said it was tomato soup. But it's,
first answer that came into his
head.
Exactly. Yeah, didn't mean it.
Yeah, exactly. Which
Blood red.
Yeah.
No, I know what tomato soup looks like. But I think, I mean, what's your favourite soup, Chris?
Chicken
Don't
broth.
Answer it. It's a stupid question. No. That's the point.
It's really stupid. I feel so embarrassed
chicken
about
broth.
It.
Is it really? Mm. Is broth a soup?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it not a broth? I think we're getting off the track.
Yeah.
Here.
Okay.
So, yes. Hellraiser, original working title, Sadomasochists from Beyond the Grave. Sometimes the first idea is the best idea. Love that title. So this was Clive Barker, the horror author's directorial debut that he decided to do because he had two other movies that I didn't bother to look at the names of that he calls abominations made of his work. And he was like, screw this, I'm doing it.
One of them was called Rawhead Rex.
Oh, I have heard of that.
Yeah, not good.
He said if they turned out all right, he would have been happy to be a screenwriter for the rest of a writer for the rest of his life. But he was appalled by how they turned out. So he decided he was going to direct The Hellbound Heart, which is his novella. And then he turns that into Hellraiser.
And it's a hell. Excuse the pun, hell of a debut. I mean, I watched it years ago and I remember being very scared. I watched it this time and I wasn't scared. And the one bit that I remember, you know how you remember one scene like we were talking about with The Fly? The scene that I remember as a kid is with the creature that I think is called the engineer, but I didn't know that at the time. It's the big scorpion fetus.
I like to call it a penis prawn.
Penis prawn, scorpion fetus. Chris?
The engineer.
Great.
Yep.
Got to get that fact in. So that thing, when it's coming down the corridor, pulling itself against the walls, along the walls, chasing the little daughter, that was the moment that I remembered that really scared me.
Is that because you could see the bloke behind him on wheels? You can see, it's so clear, you can see the wheels and someone pushing it.
No.
It's such a shame. Which, I mean, that's harsh to say that, because what I think one of the most remarkable things about it is that this film was made for £1 million.
At the time?
Yeah. Which is unbelievable when you consider how good it looks.
But that's a lot of money at the time, though.
Not really. This was 1987, so you're talking about movies being made for 50 million plus.
Okay.
But yeah, it was because it was Roger Corman's film company that gave him the money.
New World.
Yes, yeah. New World. And they.
It was originally Branson.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was going to be a Virgin film, but when they read the script, they changed their mind.
Oh.
They were up for doing a horror film with Clive Barker until they read it, and they were like, yeah, we can't do this.
So let's establish how the action takes place pretty much in one house. So a couple have moved from New York to apparently somewhere? In America.
But is it though? Because the house is clearly a British English house.
So interesting fact, it was shot in England.
It was shot in, this is so distracting, in basically my mother-in-law's old house. Like not literally, but it's so, that family are from the 1930s.
Yeah.
Nice little suburb of London house with the stained glass windows, the narrow staircase, everything is exactly the same. And it was so off-putting.
So it's a family home that this husband and wife, she's clearly not happy going there. She wants to be in New York, but he's dragged her there. And it's a family home. and they find out that his brother, the deviant Frank
has
been
Frank.
Yeah, he's been hanging out in the attic exploring sexual pleasures with the use of this puzzle box we see him pick up at the start at some sort of ancient Indiana Jones style
Moroccan market.
Best thing about that scene, how filthy his fingernails are.
I knew
are.
You'd pick up on that. Clean your fingernails, right? Dude. Yuck.
But I think it's very clever. It's the suggestion that he's so into disgusting sexual gratification that he doesn't even bother with hygiene anymore.
He's literally filthy.
Yes.
Yeah. In every sense. That's what you meant. Yeah. Got it now. Mm-hmm. Got it now. I'm with you. I'm here. So he gets his puzzle box. It releases the Cenobites, which are these demons from hell who give you this amazing pleasure, but simultaneously kill you and keep your soul.
Yeah. They can't tell the difference between pleasure and pain, or Frank can't tell the difference anymore, or something like that. I wasn't very clear on that.
So it turns out that the wife has previously had an affair.
Yes, she has.
Frank.
And what I will say now is you see that Julia, she's called Julia, she met Frank, and I would say never trust a man leaning on a doorframe in the rain because no good will come of that.
He's probably wearing white socks as well.
I know, she opens up, she's like, hello, Julia's residence or whatever, and he's like leaning, dripping wet through, I'm Frank. And it's like, don't let him in. And I couldn't decide if it was one really great afternoon or lots of great afternoons.
Well, the first time, or one of the times, is literally on her wedding dress.
That is so impractical.
They have sex on her wedding dress.
Before she's married.
Yeah.
Which is silly, because after you get married, you always dry clean that thing anyway. So maybe wait, because are you going to dry clean it before the wedding? And that's really suspicious. I don't know. It just didn't seem.
Well, let's talk through that scene, because I think you're absolutely right. He's like the sleaziest man in the history of cinema when he's leaning on the door and he's like, can I come in? Can I come in? Do you have a towel? This is not my real voice. Because he was an English actor, Sean Chapman, that New World said, yeah, we're going to relocate to America, dub him. Yeah. So it's not his voice.
They dub most people in the film, which is quite distracting, isn't
it?
It's
so obvious as well.
Yeah, it does not work, because you never for a second think you're in America.
No.
I don't know what that is. There's just something grey about England that is instantly recognisable.
Yeah, it was just the house. And then at one point, Kirsty's walking through the docks and it's like, it just looks like England.
So Frank has an affair with Larry's wife, Julia, his brother's wife, Julia, and comes up with genuinely one of the worst things to say post-coitus, which is, it's never enough.
Yeah.
Immediately afterwards, it's never enough. I mean, that's up there with, shall I call you a cab? it's genuinely one of the not unsaid things.
It's
like, sorry, remind me of your name. One of those. Yeah. I think I might have pooped. That's up there.
Oh dear.
Yeah, but this movie does have a number of things which should never be said post sex, because when the daughter and her new boyfriend Steve have sex, she wakes up moments later and goes, "Daddy."
They're in separate beds, aren't they?
But I think the suggestion is they've I mean, that's
I mean,
weird.
I didn't get it because, why has he got two single beds in his room? Is he running a hostel?
Well, I think what you pointed out there is how underdeveloped Steve's character is.
Possibly.
Yeah. He turns up and you think he's going to die because he's a douche.
He's awful,
over dinner.
He says to Kirsty, the daughter, in front of her dad, what does he say? Like, oh, drink more and get on your back or something fucking dreadful.
No, he goes, drink some more of this. And she goes, oh, I won't be able to stand up. And he goes, well, then lie down.
Yeah, in front of her dad. Yeah. Oh, excuse me, Steve. Fuck did you just say?
So I think the big thing we have to establish is in the loft of this house, Frank's undead corpse is reanimated after Larry's blood is spilled. Julia goes, I still fancy you because you're such a sexy
man.
Skinless walking corpse.
Yeah, I mean, Barry Norman did not like this film. I have some quotes from him in a bit, but for that sequence, he says that he looks like an obscene, immobile raspberry ripple.
Oh.
It's kind of true.
Yeah. I mean, what I love is the fact that even though he's got no skin and his organs are on display, I mean, he should clinically be dead, he's still like, hey, how are you doing, Julia?
Fucking men. The distance he covers, he's like, I think he does say, don't look at me, look away. And then one murder later, gets a bit of skin. He's like, come here, I'm going to put my fucking finger in your mouth. Like, Jesus.
I wonder what you were going to say then.
And it's like, and then I just really, he starts wearing like 70 suits.
Yeah, I like that though.
Yeah, but that really needed a scene where he walked to like the boxes that are in storage next door, and it's like him trying on different suits. Like, what offsets having no skin?
How long have I been away? I don't know. Like, things must have changed.
Yeah. Julia then brings him various. She basically picks up loser or nasty guys in some cases.
Very clearly British men.
Yes.
They look, there's something about their chubby baldness.
Yeah. And their sand. White pants and all of that.
Yeah. Drags them back to the loft on the promise of sexual intercourse. And yeah. Then Frank sticks his fingers in their neck and sucks out all their fluids for.
Yeah, she bashes them over the head with an axe.
Every drop of their blood puts more flesh on his bones.
Correct. Mm.
Do you know how many scenes in movies we've had to do recently where people get their freaking teeth knocked out? Ugh. The first guy in this, it's a hammer to the teeth. And you see, it's like, apparently they had to cut a scene there to get a rating that was acceptable for the British Board of Censorship, because there was a shot of him with a hammer embedded in his head and a shot of like teeth being literally knocked out with a hammer. So they got rid of those. They also got rid of a scene in the flashback scene. You know, the sexy scene where Julie's having the affair with Frank. And there's sort of two versions of this. One is Clive Barker sort of talks about it, where he said he had to take some stuff out of the flashback scene for the censors, shorten some of the violence and take out the spanking.
Oh, okay.
And then there's another quote where he's a little more direct about what they had to take out. And he was like, they wanted to substitute one kind of undertow for another. I had a much more explicit sexual encounter between Frank and Julia, but they said, no, let's take out the sodomy and put in a flick knife.
Sorry.
Well, the BBFC kept telling him that it was too shocking.
It was just the letter, because it would have been a letter back in the day. Hey, Clive. Replace sodomy with flick knife. Best. BBFC.
Well, they kept
things
telling...
I never thought I'd write. The life of a censor.
Not all heroes wear capes, guys.
But he shouldn't be using a flick. He takes off a bra with a knife. I'd be like furious. I'd be like, do you know how much this costs?
That's what I'm saying.
I'll
how many
just
of these
take
you think
off?
I've got? Yeah, just ask. You can ask me in a like authoritative way. You can use the knife to ask. Whatever. I will take this off.
Yeah. At least the first guy that she drags back to be eaten by Frank is an awful guy, because he, like, you think he's a little bit naive at first, and then when she's like a bit nervous because she's like, I don't really want to kill you, and then he's like, you're not gonna fucking change your fucking mind,
are
you?
Woman.
I want to fuck right
now.
Yeah,
hate you.
Fuck. And then she goes, yeah, you're dead now.
You'll do.
Yeah. Chris, how do you feel about all the loft stuff? Did you like it? I love the bit where Frank first comes out of the floor, by
That's
the way.
Cool, yeah.
The effects in that are incredible. Yeah.
I mean, what I'll say about both these films is it's incredible puppetry work. It's a real, you know, there's no CGI in either of these movies because we're pre that era. And you can see why people say they want practical effects, because there's something tangible about that creature emerging from the ground. Yeah.
It's true. What do you think, while we're talking about effects, let's introduce the Cenobites. Mm. I want to call them the villains, but they're not really, because Frank
they're
is the villain.
They're doing their job.
They're doing their... No, equally, exactly. That is their culture, and they've been summoned to do what they do.
They
so,
say repeatedly.
The Cenobites, a bit of background on them. Mm. They are theologians from a religious sect in hell known as the... Do you know what it's called?
Sexy time.
It's called the Order of the Gash.
Fuck off.
I'm genuinely...
Wait.
That's true.
Within the movie or within the book? He created that.
Yeah, they're called the Order of the Gash. That's in the book.
Mm.
And they just... I'm not making it up. You're looking at me like I've made it up.
I'm not saying you're making it up.
Had I known that at the time, I'd have had a better question than one about soup. Doug, tell me about this gash.
Tell me about this gash.
They describe themselves as explorers in the further regions of experience. And Clive Barker on the commentary calls them agents in the art of refined pleasure and pain.
Mm. I like the design. Clive Barker says he wanted to do an equivalent of Freddy Krueger's fedora and striped sweater and burnt face in terms of pinheads look. And he says the Cenobites look was inspired by S&M clubs.
Yeah, no shit.
On the S&M sliding scale, I'm probably a 6. There was an underground club called Cellblock 28 in New York that had a very hard S&M night. No drink, no drugs. They played it very straight. It's the first time I saw people pierced for fun. It was the first time I saw blood spilt. The atmosphere definitely informed Pinhead. No tears, please. It's a waste of good suffering.
Yeah, he wanted them to be punkish and priestly, and he told the designers that they should have exposed areas of flesh where torture has occurred, and he said he wanted them to look like magnificent super butchers.
Band name, called it. Band name. We are magnificent super butchers. Hello, Cleveland. And I forgot to say, that resurrection scene we were talking about where Frank comes up from the floorboards, mm-hmm. it was Bob Keane who worked on Star Wars that did the effects work on that. So that's probably why it's so good.
Yeah. I like him, though. So you've got... he didn't really have a name in the book, the Pinhead character.
Well, he didn't have a name in this. He was called Lee Cenobite.
Yeah, some people call him Priest. Clive Barker says he has a name, which he hasn't revealed. Interestingly, in the book, he had a woman's voice.
Okay.
And obviously, he very much does not in this film, because the voice that Doug Bradley uses is such a big aspect of why this character works.
Yeah.
I mean, do they have a gender? Like, not an agenda. Sorry, that's my accent. Mm-mm. Gender.
An agenda?
As in, today we're going to... No, gender.
So, guys, gather around. First up, we've got this rumour going around that Frank might still be alive.
It might be in America. It might be in Honor Oak Park. We're not sure.
Sorry, chattering, Cenobite. Can you fucking stop chattering? Because those teeth are really annoying. I'm trying to hold a meeting.
No, a gender. Mm. As in, an identity aligned with sex organs.
I think so, because there is a female Cenobite who's listed as female Cenobite, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Well, then what makes her female? Oh, she's got eyeshadow on. Sorry. What am I saying? Sorry, off moment.
Sorry, was that she's whole probably thing bit, leading up to...
No, she's probably a bit moody once a month as well. That's what makes her...
For 7 days.
Sorry, I was going to say something, but I'm not. Doug Bradley says... he was actually originally offered two roles. He'd been friends with Clive Barker since high school. And he was offered one of two roles. He was Pinhead, or he was going to play one of the delivery men.
Yeah.
You know, the leery delivery man who was like, you got any beer? Your daughter has your mother's looks.
Who's actually become, that actor's become a very successful director.
Not your mother's looks, her mother's looks.
He's directed a bunch of Oscar Wilde movies, adaptations.
What's he called?
Oliver...
Wilde. I'm kidding.
the delivery man?
Yeah.
Really?
I forgot his name, sorry, but...
He said, Doug Bradley said, there was no doubt in my mind that the unnamed guy with the pins in his head had a certain je ne sais quoi that mattress guy didn't deliver.
He should be called Nailhead, for the record. Yeah. They tried pins and they were too small and didn't look good, so they used nails, so he's actually Nailhead.
And what do you make of the daughter? Because she's kind of the hero of the piece. And I think the actress, is it Ashley Lawrence? I've seen one other Hellraiser movie, because I think there are nine sequels.
There are nine. Yeah. Doug Bradley's Pinhead in seven of them, but there's nine altogether.
But Clive Barker didn't do any of them.
He was involved with the second one.
And I think he tried to get a remake off the ground. He was writing a remake, but it's not seemed
keep
like...
Keep stalling, it. Yeah. That's been...
She's in a few of them. The one I've seen is there's one where there's a DJ Cenobite and he fires CDs at a crowd of clubbers. I was like, I don't know which number.
That's the one you watched.
This has jumped the shark very quickly.
Because the second one has all the same characters. It's almost like it's a two-parter. It's not as good, but the second one feels like it's part of this story, whereas that's...
It's a DJ Cenobite and his decks fire CDs at people.
I mean, I would go to that club.
Sorry, you get so high on the danger.
Ashley Lawrence. I mean, she's disastrous,
her
performance.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, I think she's... I mean, it's like she's never acted in her life. I think it was her first film.
But the thing is, when you first meet her, she does seem a bit like she doesn't quite know where she is. But then I thought that was like a nice naivety. Like, she's really cute and sweet and sort of innocent. Mm. And then you've got to think about the work involved in being on a set like that all day, every day. You've just got to look terrified constantly. Mm. And I think she does a really good job of looking terrified constantly.
Mm. Yeah, she's thrown some curveballs in it. Like, she has to deal with the grasshopper-eating hobo. Which I really wish they hadn't picked grasshoppers for that scene, because grasshoppers are actually something you can eat and it's not particularly grotesque. I think if he's in a pet shop and if he'd reached into a cage and pulled out a kitten and bitten its head off, I'd have been like, that is fucked up, dude. Whereas grasshoppers, you're like, meh, you know, people do that. I've seen Celebrity Get Me Out of Here or Ima, comma Ima.
No, you're not. You wish. He's called, the commentary, they call him the Vagrant Dragon.
Oh,
I think
that's
a funny name for that character.
That is good. Yeah.
He's the protector of the box, isn't he?
Yes.
And he looks like a homeless person.
Correct. Yes.
Cheers. So, is the hangover kicking in?
Just going to slow it right down.
towards the end then, shit goes off for Frank because Ashley goes, yo, Cenobites, I know where Frank is. He escaped you. Come get him. And then Frank is disguised as his brother Larry, which I'm unclear. Is he transformed somehow into Larry or is he literally just meant to be wearing his skin?
No, he's wearing his skin because you can see the sort of stitch marks around his...
You can. Ashley doesn't, though.
She doesn't.
Like, Dad, are you all right? He's like, are you buying this? Yeah. And he's sure.
His Larry skin suit is a bit slack, isn't it? He's having to pull...
I couldn't look.
Yeah. But then straight after he's kind of pulling the
Stop doing that.
He has sex, which makes me wonder where else he's slack and what that sex is actually like.
Excellent.
He shags Julia.
He does shag Julia. Yeah. You're right. Which actually is quite sweet. If you're thinking about this as a love story, it's quite a sweet thing because she wasn't attracted to Frank because of how he looked. Because... He now looks like her husband, who she wouldn't not love, but she'd gone off.
But from start to finish, Frank has pretty much been an absolute dick to her.
Yeah,
he has. And yet she's still surprised when he dips his fingers into her, weird sentence, and goes...
Not that weird.
And she's going, no, Frank, not me, okay, man. Yeah. Oh, my severe,
sorry,
my severe
babe.
Hair.
Nothing personal.
Her hair gets more and more severe as more and more murders she does.
Yeah, really. Puts 10 years on her, and it shouldn't.
Do you think she was well cast? Claire Higgins, who's a very... acclaimed stage actress.
Yeah.
Because I know in the book...
Why don't you?
Well, in the book, in the novella, she is supposed to be the most beautiful woman in the world and no man can resist her.
That's a tall order.
Now, what I would say for the casting in this is she's not traditionally beautiful, is what I'm going to say.
But a quiet power.
Mm.
Which is what, you know, not a thing.
Do you think that works, though? Because in the book, she's irresistible. I didn't buy her being irresistible in this film.
But I buy the fact that I quite like the fact that
who writes a fucking character description as she's the most beautiful woman in the world?
Wasn't it Homer?
Simpson?
That's annoyed me that you've said that. I don't know what to say now. I'm going to say nothing.
Yeah, face that launched a thousand ships and all that shit. Cool, Helen of Troy.
Very clever, isn't he?
Oh, he's so clever. Because of Einstein, I think. He just only wears black trousers. Got time to read Homer.
I like the fact that it's... you should try. Normalise it. It makes them very believable as a couple. Like, you believe she would be married to Larry.
Yeah.
Mm. And there's something very believable about their relationship. And it makes it sort of like... It's less like a sort of like stupid, like... horror movie and sort of like
relationship.
There's something real about it.
I tell you who thinks bloody good in this film as well is the guy who plays Larry, because he's Larry the loser for most of the film, and then he has to be Frank. Mm. And I think it's why he's very sort of low-key as Larry, because he really dials it up to 11 when he's Frank.
And also the guy who plays Frank at the start, Sean Chapman, is not the guy who's in the loft. That's a completely different actor who plays Frank for the monster bit.
Who he comes across very nice in the interviews. He said, I know I'm not good looking. They just wanted someone skinny. Bless him. did you recognise the actor who plays Larry? He's got a very famous role from the 70s.
Right, so is he in Bewitched? Or Genie?
No.
He looks like one of those...
He's in one of the most famous films from the set. He is Scorpio in Dirty Harry. He's the villain in Dirty Harry. Yeah.
Okay, didn't know that.
Good face.
Brother of Two-Face. Wow, it's getting late. Let's move on to the bits. So, starting with MVW, most valuable, whatever.
Well, I asked if we could change that for this one.
Oh, shit, yeah, sorry.
But I don't know if you guys, no one responded. I wanted to be most valuable Cenobite.
Let's do it.
Did people do that?
I didn't, but I can't.
No, let's not
doesn't
do
matter.
It then. There's only four
it doesn't
to pick
matter.
From.
We
can do both if you want, but let's do the best bit of the movie, the most valuable thing in the movie.
Okay.
And you can do most valuable Cenobite, Chris, because that's what you've prepared. And I don't want to throw you a curveball.
You go
first, stage.
Vicky.
Yeah.
Kirsty, the daughter. I know you don't like it, but I thought she was really good. So there we are.
I'm going to say Chatterer, because I think he's funny. And I know the bloke that plays him, Nicholas Vince. So a bit biased. But he was supposed to be, when he talks about it, he said Chatterer is supposed to be like the family dog of the Cenobites. He's very loyal. He's a bit dopey. And he will... attack on command if required. And I just think he looks funny, and Chatterer is a funny name.
I like Butterball.
Do you? Yeah. I don't like the name Butterball, though.
No, he's the only one who's actually given a name in the credits. Like, he's not just like Fat Cenobite. He's like Butterball, which is sort of weird. Oh, no, Chattering Cenobite's given a name as well, actually. But yeah, it's weird because the thing that always bothers me is at the end, she has the puzzle box and she's killing off the Cenobites or sucking them back into the puzzle box in their other dimension. And she does it to Pinhead and she does it to the female Cenobite and she does it to Chattering Cenobite. Butterball Cenobite just gets crushed by some ceiling.
Beam, yeah.
And you're like, you never see him disappear. It's like, so is he dead? Is he still in this dimension?
He's pinned to the floor.
Yeah. But I liked him.
The concept of him's good. Like, he's eaten so much that his stomach has split and is stitched together. And I think that's the
guy at the start of Seven.
Yes.
Yeah. Gluttony.
It is.
Gluttony. Favourite scene?
When Frank is resurrected. And obviously it's good choreography and like sort of crawls across the floor and it's fucking terrifying.
Chris?
I think it's hard to top the moment at the end when Larry slash Frank has his skin stretched off his face.
Blech.
Followed by a fleshy explosion as he says the words Jesus wept. Famously it was fuck you in the script, but Andrew Robinson, the actor, thought that was a bit of a cliche and a bit boring. So he's the one that came up with Jesus wept. And what do we know about that phrase? It's from the Bible. It's the shortest passage in the Bible.
Oh.
The shortest sentence in the Bible is Jesus wept. And it's said in regards to Lazarus, the character in the Bible that comes back from the dead. So thematically,
I know that one.
A really good line.
It's my favourite.
I know Adam, Eve, Lazarus.
Yeah. It's Let There Be Light and Jesus Wept. They're the classics.
For sure.
Yep. But they, yet again, Clive Barker was forced to cut this scene for the BBFC. He took out Larry smiling and licking his lips before he explodes.
See, I saw him do that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he does still do a little bit of that.
Yeah.
My problem with it is, I agree that fuck you is a cliche. Jesus wept because I didn't know all that backstory that you just told us about the Bible, surprisingly. It doesn't work for me as a line.
I think,
because he is smiling and grinning, I think the line should have been, it was worth it.
Yeah.
Like, that works for me. Yeah. Like, because it's like, I'm actually still so into this disgusting pleasure pain mashup that it was worth it.
But the point is, he's not. I mean, Frank wanted pleasure beyond belief, but then when it actually arrived, it was not what he was expecting it to be.
No, he says he didn't care. He does a bit of expositional explanation to Jesus, like, got this box off this dude, and it promised me pleasure or pain. He says, and by that point, I didn't care which.
Right, because I'm thinking more maybe about the book then.
Okay.
He's expecting just it to be a massive shagathon. And in the book, when he's when he's opening the box and he's prepared the room, he's apparently got several jugs of urine that he's prepared just in case that's what they're into. Genuinely, that's in the book.
What?
It's true.
I thought you were going to say, like, a little bit of massage oil.
No, there is. There's, like, petals. He's strewn petals on the floor. All these romantic things.
Nice.
And a few jugs of piss.
Yep. Piss? Yep. No.
Got some demons coming over. Have you got the piss jugs?
Al, what's your favourite
piss jugs, band name called it. So I've got a couple of favourite things. First of all, there were a few taglines for this that you'll remember from the poster that we all loved, or Vicky and I did. Chris, oh, you remember it too.
Yeah.
The posters were, the taglines were, it will tear your soul apart, or he'll tear your soul apart. Tragically underused was another version, which was, Satan's done waiting.
Really?
Yes.
That's wicked.
And Satan's done waiting.
Amazing.
When they didn't want to call it Hellraiser, it was going to be called Hellraiser, a love story. But the studio was worried people would think it was a romance and wouldn't watch it. So when they were trying to come up with the title, Clive Barker asked his crew, and an elderly lady on the crew suggested calling it What a Woman Will Do for a Good Fuck.
Whoa.
And Clive said he really liked that because it summed up what he was trying to write.
I like you want it? You want it? Fucking have it! Because that sample is used at the start of the Senseless Things song Homophobic Asshole, which I listened to as a kid and then found out it was from this movie, which I didn't know.
Well, another famous line from the film is, we have such sights to show you.
Mm.
And what other film was that line kind of used in?
Toy Story 3?
A film that's actually similar to this film thematically. A great horror film from the 90s about opening a portal to hell.
Event Horizon.
Yes. There's a line in that where they say, I have such wonderful things to show you.
Sam
which
Neill
I'd never clocked until researching this one.
Yeah, oh, no. Doesn't he say, it has such wonderful things to show us? Isn't he talking about the ship at that point?
Not sure. Oh, I wrote down something slightly different.
Okay, no, it's fine.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. Right. What change would you enact upon this film?
Kirsty, she has to learn a skill in order to kill or send the Cenobites back to hell. She randomly opens a puzzle box and then she randomly closes it. And there should be something she learns along the way. It could be confidence. You know, this is silly stuff, but like, it could be confidence. It could be manual dexterity, whatever. But she has to learn something. She's like, at the moment of pressure, she's like, I can do it. And she does it. Not just like, if I fumble with this thing for 20 minutes, it might work.
I think it obviously goes without saying you recast Kirsty.
You're so mean!
But no, I'm don't dub the film.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous and it completely takes you out of the movie every time you see a badly dubbed actor.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the Golden Child ending. You know, in the Golden Child where Charles Dance turns into the demon.
I love that.
And when the hobo just goes, oh, by the way, I know I've hardly been in it, but yeah, I'm a demon. Give me the box. See ya.
This was the same year as Golden Child. Yeah. Just after.
Yeah, I think that's a bit weird. I really think get the fuck rid of Steve in the final battle. He has nothing to offer. It should be her versus the Cenobites. And even she seems pissed off that he's there because when they're fighting the engineer, the big scorpion fetus, what did you call it?
A penis prawn.
Penis prawn. And it's like attacking them and she's got the box. At one point, Steve goes to grab the box off her.
She looks annoyed.
She slaps him away. It's like, Steve, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. Get off the... I've already killed 3 Cenobites with this. What do you think you are going to achieve by taking it off me? I'm just like, Steve, back down. This isn't your moment, you dick.
I also wish they could have followed through with what Clive Barker had planned for this story. So his idea to continue the Hellraiser tale was Julia was supposed to become the queen of hell. And she was the ultimate overarching villain of it all. But what happened was audiences didn't embrace her as a character. They embraced Pinhead. Mm. And so it suddenly became the story of Pinhead, allied with the fact that Claire Higgins, who played Julia, didn't like horror films, didn't really want to be in it in the first place, did the second one because she was kind of obliged to, but she just wanted to get away from it all.
She wanted to get away from scenes where she has to have a wank in a loft. Is that what you mean?
She's never seen that scene. So she's only watched the first 10 minutes of Hellraiser at a screening and then walked out because she just hates horror films.
Wow.
And so I think it would have been cool if Clive Barker could have followed through his vision rather than having to sort of, the story having to go where audiences took it, which was the Pinhead story.
She has a wank in a loft.
You remember when she's thinking about Frank and she's like, and she's having a little memory and then you don't see her hand, but I bet it's gone. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, right. I was like,
why are you so confused? We've all had a wank in a loft. I'm going to go for one after this show.
No, I'm not a prude. I'm wanking in lofts left, right and centre. Not often, not mine. But I just didn't remember it in this movie.
That adds to the resale value. Great wanking space.
Felix windows are really easy to open from the outside. I'm straight in there. Whoop. All right. You ready for a quiz?
No.
I'll keep it quick. I'll keep it brief. I've got a quiz, though, because it's always fun to have a quiz.
The MASH. They did the Monster MASH.
The Monster MASH.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the MASH.
It's inspired by Monster MASH, horror movies, monsters, 2 monsters in this, but it's called Monster Cash. I'm going to list the top 10 highest grossing horror movies of all time, starting with 10 working to 1 with a description I've given them. You need to tell me what movie it is. So the 10th highest grossing horror movie of all time. Here's the description. What is this movie? It's from 2000. Han Solo and Catwoman share a home, but all is not what it seems.
What lies beneath
is the correct
answer. Oh, you fucker. Wait a minute. Is it a description you've made up?
Yeah.
Right, okay, sorry. I just needed to, just see where I was. I thought you were going to describe the story. Okay, fine.
Yeah, the pitch to the studio wasn't Han Solo and Catwoman.
Oh, are you sure you can get them? Okay, great.
It's all right. I figured it out.
He did. If he hadn't got it, I'd be like, sorry, this is my bad, but Chris is all over this shit. All right, 9. This was from 2000 as well. Made $159 million. Not actually a horror movie, so shouldn't be on the list. First one was okay.
Blair Witch.
Second one was terrible, apart from an Exorcist spoof with James Woods at the start. Third is brilliant with Charlie Sheen spoofing Signs. What movie is this? It's the first one.
The thingy, the scary movie.
Yeah!
Very good. Well played.
One each. From 8, $159 million. Actually, I think these are the domestic totals because that's... Yeah, they are. They're the US totals, sorry. Not the global totals.
Oh, goodness me.
Yeah. It's from 2018. all takes place in the sleepy town of Haddonfield. This version
Halloween.
Karen.
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 That was the working title. Let's call it Karen.
Karen!
All caps.
What are you going to see this weekend? There's a new horror movie out. What's it called? Karen! Number seven. 176 million in the US. No, from 2017. Hey, come and meet my totally woke parents who
get
aren't...
Get out.
Yes.
Oh, well.
No, I was literally saying get out.
Karen!
Fuck her off.
Okay. 195 million in the US from 2019, just last year. I haven't seen it, but I've heard it is long. Even without seeing it, I probably am still going to prefer the Tim Curry version than it.
Oh, it!
Chapter 2. Yes, it chapter 2. I'm going to give you both one.
Thank you.
So, number 5, with 232 million in the US. Yo, can we get a priest? Because I've had to tie my daughter to the bed.
The Exorcist!
I think Vicky got
yeah,
that.
She did. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not...
You didn't do the year. That's what threw me there.
Try not to be surprised. apologies. We'll recut that with me going, of course, Vicky got that. At number 4, then. Where are we now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4. Chris is on 5. Vicky's on 4. At number 4, from 1984. Vicky's favourite film.
Ghostbusters.
Oh, you... Oh.
That's weird that I got that.
That's outrageous.
Where are you?
You're looking at me like it's my fault. It's
Karen!
It's just not how my brain works. I hate this.
At number 3, with 260 million from 1975, my favourite film.
Jaws.
Jesus Christ, guy. You both got Vicky's favourite film. I mean, Vicky obviously did. Jaws. Chris, did you not know?
I did know that. Okay. Why you don't get in the seat.
6-5 to Chris. At number 2, with 293 million worldwide from 1999, the Chinese translation of the title...
The Sixth Sense.
The Blair Witch Project.
The Sixth Sense is right.
Oh, wow.
The Chinese translation of the title was unbelievably, he's a ghost.
That's so brilliant.
Apologies to anyone who hasn't seen The Sixth Sense yet.
We're not doing spoilers for movies in 1999.
Are we up to number one?
This is the number one.
I'm going to go It Chapter One.
Yeah, you're right, bloody hell.
How is that fair?
You could have done it.
You could have known what I was going to do and researched the highest grossing horror movies. That is the quiz for this week. Chris is the winner. Congratulations, Christopher. We are on to the verdict.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
What are you going for this week? Are we going The Fly or are we going Hellraiser as the perfect Valentine's Day movie and also the better of the two? I'll start with you, Victoria.
I really want to pick Hellraiser because I had such fun watching it, and because of my history with that film, it feels like it would be making up for past misdeeds. Mm-hmm. But The Fly is just a more polished, more enjoyable film, and because of Jeff Goldblum's performance as well. So The Fly.
Okay. I am going to go next. No, I'm not. I'm going to let Chris do it.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, I know. I don't know why I jumped in there. I apologise. Very rude. Very rude of me.
I don't really care about anyone in Hellraiser. Much as I love that film, I'm much more emotionally involved in The Fly, and I can really empathise and sympathise with those characters. And because it's Valentine's Day, we've got a film about sexual obsession versus a film about love,
yeah,
and I'm going to go with the one about love, The Fly.
Well, The Fly is our winner then this week for completion, because I am a completionist. I am going to go with, The Fly. The Fly. I thought Hellraiser was great, and I would recommend anyone watching Hellraiser. Yeah. It's a great movie.
It's brilliant.
But The Fly is just, you know, it gets you here, I'm pointing to my brain, and here, I'm pointing to my heart.
Where you would have a heart.
Whereas Hellraiser just gets you here.
What are you pointing at, Alex? Why are you pointing at your nose?
All of it's Meet the Feebles.
He was pointing at his dick.
Cool, cool, cool. Cool. Nothing left to the imagination. What's the point of us doing a podcast? We might as well do it on TV.
Is that an option?
I wish I'd known about that.
Any producers listening?
Right then, that is it. The Fly is the winner this week. Who is deciding our movies for next week when I am away?
That is a very good question. It is me.
Yeah.
And the...
Oh, sorry, that was my computer going, hello. You've got an email. I don't.
And the films I am going for are Vicky, you have the movie Goal.
Oh, right.
And Alex, you have the movie Escape to Victory.
Except I don't have the movie Escape to Victory because I am not here. We have a very special guest on the podcast in my absence who I've told to throw the show, so it's not that good. We have the Football Ramble's gorgeous Pete Donaldson sitting in this chair.
Pete Donaldson, you have Escape to Victory.
There you go, which will be a great show. I'm so sorry that I'm not here for the football show.
Oh. How did that happen?
Don't spoil the connection.
You're right. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening. It is football week next week, so I'm shooting off. We would love it if you would rate and review us and also subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for listening. Back in a week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.